Thank you for finding your way up the hill. For how many is this your first time? Half. So welcome. Thanks for coming. Today's kind of a special day. Every day is a special day, of course, to us, but it's a very sweet day in particular for our Sangha, who has invited Chodo to come and give a way-seeking mind talk. So this is not something that happens every Sunday. It's a kind of a special practice where we ask students to reveal themselves, so how they came to practice. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, and then he'll tell you more. Chodo David Dietrich was introduced to Zen practice in 2012. In 2012, there was a sitting group in Santa Barbara that was led by Tony Johansson, who was a student of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who you heard in the chant this morning. Dave had spent decades exploring Western and Eastern spiritual traditions by the time he found this sitting group. With time, that sitting group evolved into Santa Barbara Zen Center, and Dave was privileged to practice and study with Sensei Gary Koan Janka, who is also my teacher at Santa Barbara Zen Center. For a number of years, we had the incredible pleasure of his company and wisdom on the path, and that is also where we met each other. I lay ordained him here at Jikoji in January of 2024. That means he sowed this rakusu and accepted and received the bodhisattva vows. Dave continues to study with me, with you, with the whole world, and he serves also as co-temple manager at Santa Barbara Zen Center. We're very happy to welcome him here to give his very first talk at Jikoji.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome. It's really nice to be here in this beautiful center among old friends and to see so many new faces. As you've heard, I've been invited by Sensei Nenzen to give what's referred to as a way-seeking mind talk. It's kind of a mouthful. And as I understand it, it's an opportunity for me to share a bit about my life, what brought me to Zen practice, how it's going, and where I think it's going. Because I've got the floor for the next 40 minutes or so, this is probably going to look like it's about me. I'm going to be sort of relating my experiences, but I really hope this is more about all of us, because I suspect that the things that brought me into Zen practice and a strong interest in it is likely the thing that's brought you here today or also curious about this practice. And that is, for me, a desire to understand my life, to find my reason for being here on the planet, how to live my life with meaning, and also how to deal with suffering in my life. In Zen practice, we often refer to the three treasures that we take refuge in: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Or said another way, Buddha's awakening, his teachings, and the truth about the world, and our fellow students, people that are on this path together, supporting each other. After being in Zen practice for a number of years, I think it's fair to say that this practice isn't about us deriving a personal awakening or awareness, although that's probably what drove me initially and maybe has driven you. Rather, I think that studying the Dharma allows us to glimpse the truth behind the delusion that we're separate from one another, that we have a distinct identity that's me apart from you, where I believe the reality is that we're all just wonderfully interconnected with each other and with everything that exists. So moving past these preliminary comments, I'll tell you a little bit about my life and what brought me into this practice. I grew up in a household of people that were just very interested in spirituality and learning more about their lives. And that quote attributed to Socrates, that the unexamined life isn't worth living, just hung over our household all the time. And so I was in a family of seekers. So I was born and raised in Seattle, Washington, but moved several times. Then I've lived in Sacramento, Tucson, Santa Barbara, and had stops in Michigan and New York as part of my college studies. For the last 40 years, I've lived in Santa Barbara, which I'm really glad about because I love the ruggedness of the mountains of the West, and I love the ocean, and those things are right next to each other in Santa Barbara. So I'm a really happy camper where I'm living. I have an older sister, older by 5 years, and we shared wonderful parents. My mom and dad were themselves children of the Depression, didn't have a lot of money growing up, so working hard, making a living, and learning to be self-sufficient were really high priorities in our family. My parents were loving and engaged with us, but to a certain extent, I also think that they considered us as extensions of themselves. So when we were really good kids and achieved things and compliant, we heard about it and we heard the approval and the pride. But if we were not compliant or disobedient or sort of struck out on our own with our own strong opinions, there could be quietness and there could be a chilliness, a backing away and a coolness. I think that they thought if we made a mistake, it was a reflection on them as parents. In Zen practice, we often refer to causes and conditions, things that happen in our lives, things that we do ourselves or circumstances around us that happen at one time in our lives that have ripple effects into other parts of our lives. And I can remember growing up in my family, one of those sort of significant cause and condition moments. I was about 8 years old, and over the period of about 3 months, family members, very close family members, died unexpectedly. It was shocking, and it threw our family into a deep period of mourning that lasted a long time, more than a year. The curtains were drawn, parents mostly withdrew and stayed in their rooms. Quiet was maintained, and my sister and I were sort of left to our own to figure it out. Why is this house a mausoleum at this point? I think at that moment, my sister and I sort of developed different roles within our family. My sister took on the role of the rebel. She was just a hard ass and hated what was going on and expressed it. I took the other route. I became the more compliant child, and I learned how to use humor to try to cheer up grieving parents and people around me, and to diffuse tension. And I think I developed a persona that was kind of constantly amiable and pleasing, sometimes at the expense of getting my own needs met. But one thing I appreciated about my parents, and in fact, my parents, grandparents, and everyone around them in our friendship group, was that they were seekers. They wanted to try to find a pathway, a truth, or a happiness in their lives. I think they wanted to live happy, ethical lives. And so there was lots of spiritual reading, but lots of attending different churches. And I'm going to share a litany of all those churches I got to go to as a child. And you may have been to some of these, so if I say some things that are slightly critical, please realize I'm not criticizing those churches. They just weren't for me at one point. Early memories for me included attending the Unity Church in Seattle. My parents were singing, praying, and listening to the service upstairs. Often the service was about scripture, while my sister and I were downstairs attending Sunday school. And again, without criticizing that approach, it felt a little bit like Christianity Lite. There was a lot of repeating affirmations. There was a lot of reinforcement to think positive thoughts. And the music was really light. It felt like show tunes, actually. For several years, I remember my grandmother would send me a holiday subscription to the Unity magazine for children. It was called Wee Wisdom. And I also remember that I really would have preferred to get a skateboard. We also attended, but less frequently, Catholic and Lutheran churches, which in contrast to Unity felt like Christianity heavy. The formality of the Mass, the focus on biblical text, discussions about social responsibility, engaging priests, and extraordinarily beautiful classical music. Outside of church, I had a pretty normal American childhood. I did well in school, I did sports, I was a Cub Scout, I loved our many pets, I was obsessed with dinosaurs, and I was fascinated, kind of morbidly fascinated, by ancient Egypt, pyramids, and how and why the Egyptians mummified their dead. Just as I entered adolescence, my family entered our Christian Science period, whose parishioners are known for not visiting doctors and where illness and other challenges in life are really seen as delusion, that you sort of had a misperception and you need to figure that out. I would call this Christianity confusing, or at least it was for me. It included a great deal of text study, and you were almost challenged to figure out the delusion, that it was almost a personal challenge to see through the error and not to see God's perfection. That's a rough simplification of it, but it's the gist as I remember it. Because I was going through puberty at the time and my body was changing, and this is a really heady cerebral practice, it was just hairy in a lot of ways. There were also periods of exploration of Eastern thought, Hinduism, yoga, stood out as profound and exotic and comforting at times, but in some ways they were culturally distant and inaccessible. It was hard to sustain. I'm grateful for this really wide-ranging exposure to different spiritual traditions growing up. Each had profound insights, symbolism, charismatic leaders, thoughtful, reflective moments, generosity and kindness. And in some cases, beautiful and inspiring music. I think it reinforced for me the idea that there may be many legitimate paths towards understanding the nature of our lives. But at the same time, jumping from spiritual tradition to spiritual tradition was frustrating. About a year ago, Venerable Jetsuma Tenzin Palmo spoke with our Santa Barbara Zen Center, and she described this kind of tendency towards pursuing multiple spiritual traditions as digging holes in the desert, but not digging deep enough to find water. And as a result, you might find yourself standing in a field littered with shallow holes, but still thirsty. When I graduated from high school in Arizona and moved to Santa Barbara to attend the University of California, I was more on my own to seek a spiritual path that felt right for me, and I dug some more holes. I studied for a while at the United Lodge of Theosophy, which was sort of an amalgam of Eastern thought. There was Hinduism, Buddhism, esoteric Christianity, and Western traditions blended together, which was stimulating. But it was pretty intellectual and hard to wrap my head around. I did transcendental meditation training with a friend for a number of years, which was comforting, but I missed a sense of community with that. I also discovered and visited a local Vedanta temple and really enjoyed its Hindu traditions. There was this incredibly beautiful location in Santa Barbara, way up high in the mountains overlooking the ocean. A beautiful temple, and you could attend evening vespers and Sunday services, and there was beautiful chanting and very, very thoughtful presentations by leaders of that church. But it didn't feel sustainable for me. I couldn't get to groundwater there. At that time, I was also lucky enough to have a number of jobs as a camping leader that took me into nature a lot. So I got a chance to spend lots of time in the Sierra Nevada or in the mountains near San Simeon, or snorkeling and scuba diving in Hawaii and the Caribbean. And I have to say that in many ways, these were and they continue to be one of the most consistent and constant spiritual touchstones for my life. Whether you're alone in a forest in the High Sierra or sharing it with other people or underwater watching the beauty of marine life and coral, the impact and sense of wholeness and perfection, and maybe the sense of the divine, although I'm not exactly sure what that means, is kind of overwhelming for me and moving, often to the point of tears. I found that one of the most profound ways of being here is being in nature. And it's a thing that reminds me of Zen practice. Nature almost forces you to be present and in the moment with the beauty of life and also sometimes with the beauty of death and the realness of death. But it's hard to live in the forest and it's hard to live underwater. So I continued to look for a spiritual practice that felt more enduring. I completed college and several years of graduate school, and in my late 20s, I jumped into the real world, job and career. For more than 40 years, I focused on the work of raising philanthropic gifts for universities, museums, and healthcare systems. It was rewarding, engaging work, and it allowed me to spend time with highly educated colleagues, generous, successful people, and to see monies put to good use, to build classrooms, to add wings to museums, to provide nursing scholarships, to buy medical equipment, and to actually build new hospitals. It involved 50 or 60 hour work weeks. Those were common. The adrenaline was flowing, and spiritual exploration was pushed a little bit to the back burner while I pursued that career. This was also a period of learning how to connect intimately to other people and to explore romantic relationships. Lots of those, but highlights included one long-term relationship that ended well and has resulted in a sustained good relationship and good friendship. And one long-term relationship that ended with a drama of infidelity, a good amount of verbal abuse and suffering, and then finally, essentially an acrimonious and financially painful divorce. The drama of the infidelity felt really personal and wounding at the time, and it was easy to place blame on the other person. But I've also noticed that with the passage of time in talking to other people, though a lot of people have been through this, it is not an uncommon thing. And in fact, you can learn from it. And in some instances, you can learn how to leave destructive situations that are just not right for you. And that was the case for me. I also had the privilege and the challenge of being the primary caregiver during the aging, illness, and deaths of my parents, things that are described in Buddhist teachings as inevitable realities of our existence. So I was more than ready for Buddhist practice and Zen practice when I discovered the Santa Barbara Zen Sitting Group led by Tony Johansson just about 16 years ago. A group of people numbering 15 or 20 met every Sunday morning in a large room in Tony's Coastal Canyon home in Santa Barbara. And it looked like this. It was surrounded by trees and natural beauty. But it was very simple, the way that Tony presented it. He had studied with Suzuki Roshi, but he did not adopt and take on a lot of the form and ritual of a normal sort of Zen formal temple. So he would teach Zazen. We would sit quietly. We would walk in meditation as well. We would chant one sutra, and that was it. And so week after week, it was just really minimalist, quiet sitting. I was hooked. It was the right entry into Zen practice for me. I got to focus for several years on sitting quietly, simply following my breath, and working on being present. It felt peaceful, authentic, connected to others in the room, and it provided a chance to hold up a mirror to myself and to watch thoughts and emotions come and go through my head. In this process, I had a chance to come face to face with some of the patterns and tendencies in my response to the world, which includes my role as the always amiable, easygoing guy. And then just under the surface, a very sort of evaluative, judgmental person, judgmental about myself and judgmental about other people. The tendencies are there still. I'm not sure I'm ever going to lose those, but I'm grateful to be more aware of them when they're taking up space in my head. And I think this practice has helped me to see them more clearly. Tony was a wonderful first teacher. He was a musician. He was a poet. He was a minimalist, as I said. And somehow, in the quiet and stillness of his home Zendo, things that I was looking for in other traditions started to come together. And it felt like there's a possibility of awakening now in this life by facing life as it comes up. Instead of finding grace after you've died in a place that you call heaven, it felt like there's something profound that you can do in this time rather than that being deferred to a later time. I wanted to share one of Tony's poems that illustrates the feel of his low-key approach to the Dharma. He was just unbelievably sort of quiet and non-dramatic in his practice of Buddhism. This is called Still Life of Still Life. One of these mornings when the butter in the butter dish looks like the butter in the butter dish, where the sunbeams in the kitchen on the kitchen table do what great paintings do all by themselves. No thought interrupts the space between the eyes and the once used butter knife. Breath falls like dust settling. The painting, if it was a painting, would be titled Still Life of Still Life. Nothing moves, only the niggle of a thought squirming, raising its drowsy head. Now? Should I say something? Not now, Still Life says. Plenty of time for that later. After several years of sitting with Tony's group, he needed to move from his house, and he also had a recurrence of cancer that progressed very rapidly. His death was a learning experience for all of those who knew him and sat with him. While the passing of my own parents was highly charged and emotional, Tony was very matter-of-fact about his impending death. When I visited him in the hospital during his final days and we held hands and breathed together, there was almost no drama, no fear, no complaining. He just seemed to face the inevitable as something else that's arising. I'm really grateful for that teaching. After Tony's death, as Sensei Nenzen mentioned, Gary Janka Koan took the helm of the sitting group and founded Santa Barbara Zen Center. And it was wonderful to be a part of that transformation of that group into a Zen Center. We incorporated as a not-for-profit. We had a board of directors. There were Dharma talks. There was forms training. There was Tokusan. There were sesshins. There were Jukai ceremonies. There were priest ordinations. So we kind of went from 15 miles an hour at Tony's house to 70 miles an hour with Tony's leadership, very ambitious, very much wanting to move the Zen Center forward. I missed the equanimity and the low-key approach that Tony brought, but Sensei Koan was just a wonderful, engaging, warm, thoughtful teacher and friend. He really had a way of just drawing you closer and deeper into practice, and I'm really grateful for that. I did struggle, though, a little bit with the more formal approach and all of the forms. And in hindsight, I realized the reason I was struggling had to do with my ego and my sense of self. I was just afraid of getting it wrong. So when you got a job to be Doan or to be Jisha or to have a service role, you're a little bit on stage, and I just was really nervous about it a lot of the time. Still nervous about it, but I'm sort of seeing that and sort of saying, okay, I'm nervous about it. When Sensei Koan stepped back for his own health reasons, a number of us who had practiced with him but also had practice relations with Sensei Nenzen began to practice in multiple locations. So some of us are practicing still in Santa Barbara with that Zen Center, and we're also connected here with the Zen Center at Jokoji, which is really wonderful and enriching, different points of view, different perspectives, but underneath that, very, very common shared teachings and shared appreciation for each other, I think. Last year, as Nenzen mentioned, I had the opportunity to go through Jukai here, studying and receiving the precepts, committing to the Bodhisattva path, and receiving my Dharma name, Chodo, which refers to morning or first light and path or the way. Which brings me to the present and the chance to be with you this morning. I want to share a couple of thoughts about where my practice is going, all dependent on kind of my health and aging and whether I get another week or year or decade or more of control and agency in my life, because I know that old age, illness, and death will be there when it's their time. When I hit an impasse in practice, Sensei Koan had simple, straightforward advice: keep going, he would say, and I hope to follow that advice. Nenzen has invited several students, myself included, to enter into what she calls priestcraft, digging deeper into Buddha's teachings, learning more about forms and practice in the Zendo, offering talks like this Way-Seeking Mind talk, participating in service to Sangha and temple life, and sewing priests' garments. I don't have strong expectations about where this will lead, but I'm grateful for the chance to go deeper, to dig the hole deeper, to work more closely with my teacher, and to share this experience with others that are on a similar trajectory. I feel blessed to be connected with an extraordinary sewing teacher. With regard to priest's robes and wearing robes like these, I have always thought there was fundamental truth in Thoreau's words that we should beware of all enterprises that require new clothes. Somehow, my teacher, Ann Johnson, has been able to make sewing and meditation almost one and the same. I have concerns about being worthy of wearing the robes. Concern that it may send a message about achievement on my part or separateness on my part from other people. But I just continue to watch those thoughts and deal with them as they come up. I just want to close by sharing a few observations about some of the things that seem to be coming up again and again in my Zen practice as sort of truisms after practicing for 16 years. These may not be true for others in this tradition, but they're sort of holding true for me at this point. And the first is the self that I've been carrying around for more than six decades, with its narrative about who I am and how I'm distinct from other people, isn't a concrete or real thing. It's something that's been constructed over time by my thoughts, my childhood experiences, my childhood conditioning, what people have told me, and a lot of other things. But it's not real. It's a set of stories. And I hang on to them occasionally and occasionally defend that sense of self and the story. But Zen practice has helped me on occasion to see through this and to see myself as not distinct from others, but fundamentally connected to others. I've noticed that when I attach to my sense of self, to my stories, and I hold them tight, I tend to suffer. When I consider myself more openly as connected to other people, the suffering diminishes. Second sort of truism for me is that Buddha's fundamental teachings about suffering seem to just ring true again and again and again, just at face value, but also in practical everyday experience. When we cling to things tightly and things that are impermanent and are going to change, we suffer. And when we push things away that are also things that are just real, we suffer. And we get angry, and we are fearful, and we despair. So I found that for myself, if I ask myself questions when I'm in those states, what am I clinging to here? What am I trying to push away, and why? Almost always sort of takes the heat out of the emotion and the suffering for me. And a third thing that seems true is that sitting Zazen is so incredibly helpful, and doing it consistently is so helpful. But taking that ability to kind of watch what your mind is doing off the cushion into life as it is when you're driving a car, dealing with other people, is also just as important and really, really helpful. Fourth thing that's been a takeaway for me is that communicating love, caring, and concern, and acceptance of others, and acceptance of yourself is almost invariably the right thing to do. People need to hear it. You need to do it. And you need to show it. And listening more than talking is one of the ways that you can facilitate and make that happen. And I think this is especially true when we're living in such divided and polarized times. Lastly, I'd say what seems a truism to me is that it's really, really helpful to spend time in nature, to spend time with animals, and to spend time with children if you can. And I think it's in some ways that time in those three circumstances helps remind us or bring us back to beginner's mind, because there's a simplicity and a straightforwardness to nature and to animals and to children that's a really strong reminder of our beginner's mind. So I'm going to sort of wrap it up here. I feel like I'm a work in progress, like we're all a work in progress. I think I'm something of a mystery to myself, as we're all a mystery to ourselves. But it's been really, really, really joyful to be able to spend this time with you and to talk a little bit about my practice and what's brought me to this place. And I'm going to conclude, as Nenzen knows, I love Mary Oliver's poetry, so I'm going to close with a poem by Mary Oliver called Mysterious Yes. Truly we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of the lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or from the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. I think this might be a time when we open the floor to comments or questions or reactions, and so I'll do my best to respond to any questions or thoughts or comments that you have, including our folks who are watching online.
So you can raise your hand or gassho just to get Chodo's attention.
Thank you for well, I feel it's an inspiring talk and resonant with me personally. My question is about kind of, I guess, the phases of spiritual seeking. So when you were a child and then a teenager and went through college, you were seeking for something. You were seeking something, right? That water, maybe.
Yeah.
And then it kind of got put on hold, and then you came back to it.
Yeah.
Do you think the object of your pursuit has changed? Was there, I guess I'd like to know, going back to that time, was there an answer you were seeking? Was there some secret of the universe? And has that changed?
It's a great question. I think when I started the journey through all of these different churches, I was sort of drugged by the hand by adults because they were seeking. And so I was kind of along for the ride. And in some ways, I think it seemed appropriate to try to go and do the ritual and be serious and earnest about it as a child, because that's what was expected of you, because that's what your parents were taking you there for. So I think in the early phases, it was maybe not so much sincerely seeking, but pleasing parents. I think as I matured and developed a little bit more of a identity of my own and realized this is my life and my path, I think I wanted to really know why I'm here. When you look around, there are so many millions and millions and millions of people who have lived lives and been born and lived lives and died. And, you know, you look at that and watch that and say, is that just a random thing that's happening in the universe? Or is there some purpose for us being here? Is there something we can learn about why we're here? And is there something that we can contribute and add back to make things happier and more joyful and more connected to others, rather than just living a life that has a beginning, middle, and end, and then ends. So I think it was kind of those fundamental kind of existential questions. Why are we here? What's the purpose of all of this? I think that was the driver once I became old enough to sort of seek my own path. I don't think that's changed. I think I'm still in this practice because I'd like to really know why I'm here and what's the reason. But I feel like I'm getting more glimpses. I think we're here to love each other. I think we're here to connect to each other, to realize in reality that we're connected. We're not alone. And I think I'll stop there. Yeah. Thanks for the question.
Do you think that your exposure to all of these different religions that you tried, that it helped you when you finally found Zen, and it was like, yeah, this is what works for me?
Yeah, I do. I'm really grateful because a couple things. I think there was a richness and a beauty in a lot of those traditions that sort of touched me at a deep level. It was just hard to sustain for me. And so I think I just became more and more engaged with serve the more and more I went to different churches. I got more curious, and I wanted it to be more sustaining. I also think that when I came to Zen practice, there was a little bit of a transition from traditions where someone kind of was telling you, here's the truth and the way. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Buddhist practice and Zen practice, there's more responsibility on you, and there's more opportunity to, and some tools and thoughtful ways of approaching it that allow you to figure it out for yourself. And for me, that resonated much more. That seemed the right, it felt like, this is the right path. I think I can get to water in this, doing it this way. So does that answer your question?
Pretty much, pretty much.
Thank you.
I had a question kind of about this idea of like suffering or sharing suffering, especially with respect to loved ones who are suffering. Yeah. I guess maybe it's better, but if I just explain like the situation that I'm coming at it from. I have a close friend of mine who, her family was in Gaza and a lot of them were killed. And so it's kind of like this, how do you like come into that friendship and that relationship with that friend without trying to like dismiss the suffering, right? And trying to share the suffering, but not necessarily take it all on to myself. I don't know if you have any ideas on this idea of like what it means to be there for someone in their suffering without necessarily getting lost in it. If
yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're saying is that the friends that are sharing this with you, this is more direct and immediate to them than it is to you.
Right.
And you're trying to be a support. Yeah. I think listening, opening the door and saying, communicating, I care for you. I can feel and appreciate the suffering that you're going through because of this. You want to talk about it? Do you want to share how you're feeling with me? And then listening. And not necessarily trying to provide comfort as much as to provide your presence with that person to listen. And to share the crying or the grief. And experience it as you experience it, which is a little bit removed. But be there as they experience it, where it's much more direct for them. But right. But I think being present with them and listening is probably a good way to approach it. Hi, Tova. I'm not sure I know how to, there you are.
I got it.
How are you, Tova?
Okay. Thank you so much, Shoto. It's just wonderful to get a span of time and see some early influences. And I'm left with a feeling of continuity of you. Are you hearing okay? Can you hear okay?
We're trying to pump up the volume here.
All right.
I think that's worked. Yeah, go ahead, please.
So were you able to hear? Shall I begin again?
Could you begin again?
I can begin again. I'm saying thank you so much for being candid and open and giving us such a span of time. And so we can see the continuity of your life this way. And I appreciate that. I think your description of that we learned a year ago or so, as you said, about digging those holes in the desert and finding a way to get deep enough for water, really applies to my life, and I was happy to hear you expand it again. It just seems to me that you have carried through with some very important threads, nature, music, that have supplemented your search for present answers, because you are continually coming to the present in your practice. It was wonderful to hear you describe that. So in our Zen practice, we certainly don't, you know, we're not playing classical music. It was great to hear the light and the medium and the heavy. But we are chanting. And I didn't hear you mention that. And I wonder if that is a part of what you see that Zen has given you, is that because the music seemed important enough for you to mention in several traditions, how are you bringing that? What are you bringing forward in your practice now that has been there all along for you?
Thank you, Tova, for that question. I'll respond in a couple ways. I think that the chanting that we do in Zen circumstances has a beauty of its own, I think, because of what Nenzen was mentioning, is it's a chance for us to be one body, is to bring ourselves into kind of harmony with each other through sharing these texts, in many cases ancient texts, and trying to not be individuals, but to be interconnected as we speak or chant those words. So that has a beauty that I love and appreciate. It's a little bit different, though, than the kind of beauty and emotion that comes out of a Beethoven symphony or a Puccini opera or a piano concerto. So I think that in my life, I just recognize that I love all of the above, and I try to attend all of the above if I can. So I love being in temple and chanting in the Zendo with other people. I love going to a music hall and listening to and appreciating music or streaming it. And I realize that they're both ways that I get touched inside and moved inside. And so I just pursue all of them. Is that an answer to your question? I've heard that when there are no more questions, you've spoken too long.
No. Just give a little bit more time. There you go.
Thank you for sharing.
Sure.
My question is regarding the part you mentioned. You had a pretty fulfilling career and job, and in the meantime, like the spirituality was kind of put on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of resonate a lot to that, and wondered, like, how, looking back, how what have we done differently to kind of keep the like balance the kingdom.
Let me repeat in case not everybody heard that. I think you were referring to sort of the part of the conversation I was sharing about career, that that during a career that's really engaging and busy, it's sometimes hard to pursue a spiritual practice at the sort of same level of intensity, maybe, when you're not working so hard. I think that was your comment and question.
Yeah, and also how to just keep connected with yourself while keep the career intensity part.
Yeah. I don't think I did it. I don't think I did a great job of it. You know, I think when I dove into my career, and it was successful at it. You know, I kept getting sort of the gold star and the bigger job and all of that and lots of praise and affirmation for it. So I sort of grabbed that, and I thought, hey, this is kind of what life's about. Is getting, you know, a bigger job, a bigger title, more money, more things, more toys. I also felt that some of the work that I was doing kind of felt like spiritual work. You know, we were raising money and doing good works with it. That said, if I were doing it again, I would probably work a fewer hours. I would probably make the decision to work fewer hours, and I would probably make the decision to be more disciplined about setting time aside for the spiritual life, for the inner life. I think I actually would have been better at my job because I would have had, I think, a more kind of authentic sense of self in it. In some ways, as you know, when you walk into work, you put on the coat and the tie, and you put on the role. And it's a role that you wear throughout the day, and it's hard to take those clothes off at 5 or 6 or 7 o'clock at night and just let them go. You kind of stay in that role of work person who has the following title and the following responsibilities. So I think in hindsight, to your point, I would try to get more balanced about it just by being more disciplined and saying, okay, at this time, I'm sitting zazen. I'm going to do this now. And I'm gonna keep it as a discipline. I think we're given the chance to make that decision in our lives, and I think it's probably the right decision. Yeah, to focus on that. Yeah. Are you overwhelmed by your work and the role that you have in doing work?
So for me, I also feel that working off of the affirmation and the praise from the work is kind of attracting.
Yeah.
And then I'm also the kind of person to look at people facing and sit that attention from colleague or advisor, supervisor. And then it's kind of tempting to work longer and achieve more. And yeah, but in the meantime, it feels like somewhat empathy afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd add one thing to my response, which was I had a similar sort of experience. I was just pumped up by the work, by the connections to colleagues, by the excitement of what we were getting done together. I retired 2 years ago and sort of stepped back from work. So all of that excitement is not there anymore. It wasn't permanent. It was just what I was going through at that time. So that's why I think it's helpful to sort of think long term. How do I keep things that are enduring in my life? And how do I recognize that the work life is going to be the work life for a period of time, but it's not going to be there forever. And sort of it is going to change. So if I were doing it again, I would be more balanced. Or I hope I would be more balanced.
I think about personality. When you mentioned about when you're growing up, you mentioned if you follow what your parents do, and then, you know, then they will, you know, like appreciate you,
yeah,
and support you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do things against the parents, and then you feel, you know, not get that much supported. Yeah. And then also he mentioned about like people pleaser kind of a pleaser personality.
Yeah.
That is like you follow what the, you know, the people wish you to be. So I wonder if that growing up experience, for me, I feel like that as an Asian like kid growing up, that affect me a lot. And then I just wonder if that, do you think that formed the way of your personality?
Mm-hmm.
Does that, you know, transform you into the Zen practice? Is that any connections or how, I don't know, is that, I feel like, well, how we grow up, like it formed us a way how we are pursuing and how we want to live a lifestyle we live.
Yeah. I love that question. Thank you for asking it. If I could restate it, I think what you're saying is that if you grow up in a family where your parents' approval becomes very, very important and can affect your sense of self, that if you're a compliant, good person who achieves, you're kind of an acceptable, good person. But if you maybe strike off and have your own ideas or more independent or maybe a little more resistant to your parents' ideas, you're not such an acceptable person in your family. And I think a lot of us go through that. I think it's maybe, you're saying it might be part of Asian tradition and growing up in an Asian family, but it was certainly the same in mine. We're not Asian, you know, German and Irish. So I think where I felt I came out of that was that sort of achiever, compliant, always kind of smiling, trying to find, you know, be supportive, not be cranky and negative or disruptive. I had that, but it felt a little bit like it came out of conditioning rather than that was authentically who I was. It felt like a role I'd taken on within my family. So I think that I think I was looking in my search, and which has gotten me to this path of looking at ways of understanding myself and more authentically who I am rather than who my parents expected me to be. So I think you're right about that. It's one of the things that drew me to this practice is who am I if I can start to strip away some of the conditions, some of the conditioning and expectations on me. And if I can really look genuinely at who am I? Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for asking that question. It's a really nice question.